Kia ora, talofa, namaste, haere mai, and welcome to this week's episode of The Niche Cast. We're coming at you with a trio of really funky current sporting topics from the land of Aotearoa. We're going to get into a bit of Aotearoa Grizzlies. It's the Grizzlies season. Stephen Adams and the Memphis Grizzlies are in the NBA playoffs, and we are going to be previewing their matchup against the Minnesota Timberwolves after they won the play-in game. So big Stephen Adams yarns to be had there. We're also coming off a little patch of Aotearoa Wahine football. Football Ferns played Australia in two games and lost both, but scored goals and had a bit of fun. We've also got Aotearoa under-20s Wahine football as well. And Aotearoa's football extraordinaire, the wild card, can tie both in together. So if you do love a bit of football and Aotearoa Wahine football, check in, tap in there. And then, of course, we've got the Aotearoa Warriors facing the Sydney Roosters, which helps us get into a bit of Warriors mahi, as always. And then we chuck the Kiwi NRL goggles on, and the Roosters, as announced on the Variety Show and as announced earlier in the year, are the best Kiwi NRL club in the NRL right now. So obviously, there's plenty of Kiwi NRL angles to get through with the Roosters as well. So just concentrating on those three things this episode. And shout out to the Patreon podcast earlier in the week. We chat big cricket yarn. So if you are a fan of the Niche Cast and you want to support us straight up the guts, head on over to Patreon. Patreon.com/OurNicheCast. All these links are in the description, however you're getting the podcast. But I do want to shout out the Patreon podcast earlier in the week, focusing on cricket, because we can confirm Michael Kasprich did shit the bed when he described a Pakistani pitch as flat. And then he was quickly sent to the naughty corner, and he came back with good batting decks and all this stuff. So we did get a bit cricket conspiracy on the Patreon podcast. So big cricket focus, bit of Black Caps, bit of funky shit around the cricketing world as well. We can do big yarns about cricket. So if you do enjoy Aotearoa Cricketing Matters and you just want to support us, head on over to the Patreon. Find that link every Monday and Friday. There's a big email banger as well. Extra content there via Substack. Find that link in the description as well. And of course, we're here as the Niche Cast. And what we do every day is write about Aotearoa sport for our website, theniche-cast.com. Big yarns, the wildcard's done, big yarns, wrapping up the football ferns, the under-20s. There's big Stephen Adams check-ins as well, so if you do want to dive into that, do that. I've done a yarn about Will Warbrick from Bay of Plenty, bit of Kawarau, and he's signed to the Melbourne Storm, and he has scored 3 tries in 3 games for their reserve grade team. He's gone well. We got Warriors yarns. We got Josh Alloway yarns for the Manly Seagulls. That's kind of where my head's at right now. Focusing a lot on rugby league and having a good old jolly time doing it. Wobbly wildcard. I believe you have some mindfulness for us to ponder, get a bit in the zone, and apply. Maybe we'll apply it to some of these topics we're talking about today. Otherwise, we'll just apply it to our day-to-day lives, how we're living.
Yeah, going ancient Zen proverb here on this one. It goes, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water.
The nitty gritty.
Yeah, the nitty gritty.
I've actually heard that one before, not with the full context. I've just heard it described as chop wood, collect water, as a, you know, just a way to stay present in the moment and go about your business. So definitely can second that one, because when you're just focusing on the simple tasks that you can do and just going about your daily mahi to be the best person you can be, that's when things happen for you. That's when things open up. And I think a lot of the time we can get caught up in thinking like, oh, how's this going to happen? When's this going to happen? What's going to happen? Like, you can kind of feel it's going to happen. You can sense things are happening or whatever it is. Or like, you're just like shitting the bed with anxiety and stress. You know, like, it's not happening. Like, whatever it is, you can then chop wood and collect water. And obviously, that's a bit of an ancient way of saying, just do what's important now. do what's important next. What's your next task? What's your next job? Just keep doing that, and then things happen for you.
Yeah, like I looked this one up to see what people's interpretation of it was. And it was slightly different to what I got from it. But the most common thing seemed to be like this idea that, you know, enlightenment is for the mind, and therefore the physical self is unaffected. So you, what you're doing before, you become enlightened before your mind becomes enlightened, your soul, whatever, what were you doing before physically, you do afterwards, because nothing has changed from that perspective. I also kind of prefer it taken a little bit deeper though, into some of the stuff you're talking about there as well, where it's like, because first of all, those are acts of service in their own way, chopping wood, carrying water. Like those are like household tasks, chopping wood so that you can have a fire, so that you have warmth in the household, carrying water so that you've got water to drink for the household, to wash the dishes with, have a bath, whatever you need to do. It's not the immediate focus, is it? It's preparing for later so that you're set up. So it's an act of like training as well in its own way, and discipline and virtue and patience and things like that. So you bring in all that good stuff. And then just also like, and service as well is always an important one to keep in mind. And then also I think there's a point to that as well, to saying that those in themselves, those tasks, and any task that fits into those categories that we just mentioned, like, I think there's something to say that those are enlightening tasks. Like, it's not just that you were chopping wood, carrying water before, and then chopping wood, carrying water after. It's like the chopping wood and carrying water is part of the process of becoming enlightened, as far as I see it. Therefore, obviously, you're going to keep doing it afterwards because you know it's taking you in the right direction, right? I think that's also a handy interpretation, along with the idea that, yeah, the mind and the body separate and all those things.
Chopping wood and collecting water is the enlightenment.
Yeah.
Because it's the understanding of those simple tasks and the joy they can bring you, the gratitude they can bring you, that is part of the enlightenment cycle situation. Well, and you don't, your calf muscle doesn't become enlightened. It's your mind. So then it's transferring the mind into physical things that you can do, right?
Yeah, well, like Ram Dass would say, you know, I'm not this body, but I'm in this body. The body is part of the journey, but it's not the, like, the thing that's journeying, whatever. There is another one that sounds a bit like that I'm trying to remember how it goes. It's something along the lines of like, first I looked and saw mountains and I became wise, and I saw no more mountains and I became enlightened and the mountains came back, or something like that. I don't know exactly how it goes, but it's something along the lines of like a journey of enlightenment, where as you get further along, you no longer see mountains because you've separated, like you don't see the separateness, you see everything as one, and the mountains are the same as the valleys and whatever. But then you come back around to the point where you started from. It's almost like that hero's journey kind of cycle. You end up where you started, but you're different now, sort of thing. There's some, I don't know, listeners can look that up, something, mountains, seeing mountains, whatever. But there is another one like that. Maybe I'll try find it for next week. I don't know.
I think there's a lot of things like that in the world of
I'm sure.
mindfulness and little gems of information. Let's crack into some Stephen Adams korero here, wildcard, because the big man and his Memphis Grizzlies are in the NBA playoffs. You look around Aotearoa mainstream sporting media, this is not a big topic, but it is something that in the niche case is absolutely fizzing and frothing to work with. Stephen Adams obviously represents Aotearoa in a massive way, in a beautiful way, in a glorious way, just being himself. And he is also playing his role, do your job, do your role,
in chop wood, carry cool, water.
Chop wood, carry water. That's what Stephen Adams is doing for a very cool, funky, fresh Memphis Grizzlies team. And they are coming up against the Minnesota Timberwolves wildcard in their first round of the playoffs. Now, we're thinking Stephen Adams, we're thinking big man. And that all our focus here, like, if we're obviously from Aotearoa, so all our focus here is channeled towards Stephen Adams, is directed towards Stephen Adams. And we're talking about big men. Timberwolves have a pretty decent big man in Karl Anthony Towns, quite skillful, good shooter, bit different to Stephen Adams. And the Memphis Grizzlies have a bit of a dynamic duo, Stephen Adams and Jaren Jackson Jr., two big men with slightly different skill sets that can, like, I'm very optimistic that they can handle Karl Anthony Towns and the other randoms that the Timberwolves have as their big men. Based on what you've seen and experienced in your NBA tracking this season with Stephen Adams, or just like general fandom, what do you think this is going to happen with regards to Stephen Adams and his game time in the series? Bit of season context, the first two games between these two teams of the season, Stephen Adams played less than 20 minutes in each of those games. Third game, he was out injured, I think. And then the fourth game, the last game between these two teams this season, Stephen Adams played 27 minutes in a loss. And NBA stats, but a plus minus. Aotearoa basketball fans will be happy to know that Stephen Adams was a negative minus player in all three of those games. So how are you processing and thinking about the Stephen Adams versus Karl Anthony Towns matchup, which I believe has to include Jaren Jackson Jr., because that, yeah, just how are you, like, how do you see Stephen Adams fitting alongside Jackson Jr. in this matchup against Karl Anthony Towns?
Yeah, this whole Memphis versus Minnesota thing, like, series itself is full of these kind of matchups where it's like, it's a really fascinating one. And I kind of didn't want it for that reason. Like, I thought maybe there's a little bit too much going on, and I don't know if that's the ideal matchup for Stephen Adams, because the other opportunity would have been that the Clippers won that play-in game, and then he'd be coming up against, like, old mate Zubac, who he'd probably be able to dominate pretty thoroughly across the series. Although, I mean, if that's the case, then obviously you might get into a situation where the Clippers are going small, and then Adams is forced off the court because of reasons like that. So it can go both ways. You never quite know. But yeah, the Adams versus Towns matchup is tricky for him, I think, because he doesn't always like coming up against stretch big men, like guys who are going to hang out on the perimeter and shoot three-pointers, because it really does drag him away from the stuff that he's best at. So I wonder how that will go. Like, I suspect, to be honest, he might not guard Towns a whole lot. I think you might see him guarding, Adams playing a bit more drop coverage, and then, like, Jaren Jackson Jr. pushing up onto Towns in that situation, if that's the case. I was reading about, because Towns actually was quite terrible in the play-in game. Like, he was actually awful. Like, I think he went 0 for 7 in the first half or something like that. Didn't make a field goal at all until about halfway through the third quarter. Played through foul trouble the whole time, and even in foul trouble, he kept just doing dumb stuff and picking up more fouls, and then fouled out, like, relatively early in the fourth quarter, where you're like, well, this is the all-star on this team, and you've been kind of reckless here and left you guys, like, up the creek without a paddle. But then it turns out not to matter, because he fouls out, and then they straight up go on like a 16-2 run and surge back into the lead and end up winning the game. And Patrick Beverley goes ballistic and jumps up on the scorer's table, throws his jersey into the crowd. And Anthony Edwards was fantastic as well in that game. And it's a good reminder that that team might have one all-star, but they got, Anthony Edwards is an all-star in the making. And to be honest, give it 2 or 3 years, he'll probably be better than Karl Anthony Towns. I'm just going to throw that out. Like, that guy's fantastic. He's like a small Zion Williamson. It's like someone took Zion Williamson and was like the mold of him and was like, maybe he's a little bit too big. Maybe it doesn't work. He's constantly injured. What if we made like a 6'8" version of this, or however tall Edwards is? Like, he's a bulky dude for his size, but he's very much a winger. And he's got a decent jump shot and will shoot three-pointers and stuff. So he's a fantastic player, and does the same barging to the rim and finishing stuff that Zion's good at, but that Zion is the best in the business at, to be honest. I wonder how that works coming back around, because obviously Towns is going to be a lot better, and that's probably his worst game of the season. He's not going to play at that level again. But I was reading up on some of, like, because apparently he struggled against the Clippers all through the regular season as well. And I was reading an article about that, and they were saying like the reason they did that is because they just changed up their coverage on him, like constantly different players guarding him, a lot of versatile defenders, which makes me think, first of all, that the Grizzlies have two, like, certainly one all NBA defensive player in Jaren Jackson Jr. And I think if Dylan Brooks had been more available throughout the season, he'd, you know, likely to be pushing for those teams as well. So they got two like elite level defenders, and I don't know how much Brooks will get to play on Towns just because of the size differential, but they do have options for mixing up their defensive rotations and stuff like that. And, you know, Steven Adams is a very good defender himself as well. Dylan Brooks didn't play in any of the four games that they played against Minnesota through the season, so that's probably a pretty relevant factor as well, thinking about the series. It's the same thing as the Zubac thing, isn't it? It can go both ways, because if you're getting Jaren Jackson Jr. to be the primary defender of Karl-Anthony Towns, then you have to ask, what does Steven Adams do? And it might be a case in which you say, well, if he's not really, you know, if we're asking him to guard someone 6 inches shorter than him and faster than him, well, maybe the better option is to just like put him on the bench and bring in De'Anthony Melton and slide Jackson to the five, sort of thing. So there is that possibility. But whenever there's that possibility, there's also the possibility that the two big men will just be dominant and they'll run the show, and Adams will be like, if Towns is boxing out Towns on rebounds and Jackson's guarding him on offense, sort of thing, then maybe they've just got this perfect tag team thing where they can just take that dude out of the game, and then each of them, there's going to be someone free on both ends to just like feast, basically. So it can go both ways. Like, it might be one of those things where he gets crowded out and it's just a matchup thing where he doesn't play as much as we'd hope. It might also be a thing where he plays a whole heap because it's like, because that matchup just works in a dominant way for them. And we do know that, Ja Morant will be like absolutely fizzing for this. You know what a character he is. And Steven Adams led the NBA in screen assists, and that is a major way in which Ja Morant likes to get involved, going around a screen, attacking the basket. So there's a lot of, and Adams has been like a really crucial cog in their offense as well. So more so than defensively, I'd add. So there's also that to consider. So it's a fun matchup. There's a lot of ways in which it could go, and it's pretty exciting to see how, because there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of moving parts of this machine, isn't there? It's like one dude does well and then that has flow and effects or whatever. So I'm just excited to see how it goes. I'm hoping for the because I think the Memphis Grizzlies do have a considerably stronger team overall than Minnesota, even though they were quite evenly matched throughout the regular season. So I am hoping for that dominant, like optimistically leaning towards that thing where just him and Jackson can have field days out there and boss this game. But because the Timberwolves don't really have a lot of big man depth behind Towns. So that is another factor to consider. Because on the one hand, I'm a little bit like hesitant seeing like some of the numbers that you read out before and his minutes and stuff, and knowing that he didn't have the best games against them. But also I'm thinking like, well, that was regular season. This is playoffs. It's different now. Dylan Brooks is back now. That makes a difference. Everyone's healthy. The two of those Grizzlies games were before they sort of like flipped the switch, like during their 9 and 10 beginnings of the season, rather than their just like unstoppable like procession that followed that. So every little like concern has an asterisk, but every optimistic point also has an asterisk. And I guess that's the definition of playoff basketball, isn't it?
That's like a detailed description of like, because I'm thinking, as you're saying that, I'm thinking this series could either be Steven Adams as a non-factor, or Steven Adams is literally commanding attention from the NBA landscape. Like, holy shit, Memphis Grizzlies have all this, like, they just rolled through Minnesota, like two big men, like all that shit. Like, and it's a playoff series that could literally go either way for Steven Adams specifically. And as you said, like, there's just his skill sets can, you can argue that they aren't necessary and that they are super necessary in this contest. One thing here, Wildcard, well, two things that you've shared with us in writing about Steven Adams and talking about him is his rebounding and his assist ability. You mentioned screen assist, but that's a different thing as well to regular assist. So you might get a situation the in favor of Stephen Adams, you might get a situation where Minnesota just have no answer, because they are quite a good defensive team, a lot of defensive effort, gritty, niggly, all that shit, but they also might not have a defensive answer for Stephen Adams playmaking in the little zones where he likes to playmake. Another thing Stephen Adams is really good at is rebounding, and apparently Memphis are the best rebounding team in the NBA. You've done a fantastic job of outlining Stephen Adams' stats and his record-breaking stuff as well. So if you are listening to that, to this, make sure you check out Twitter or Big Stephen Adams Yarns, because there's a lot of statistical record-breaking type information that the Wildcat has shared about Stephen Adams. Memphis are first in rebounds per game, 58.2. Minnesota are 16th with 52.4, which is a decent difference. Not a huge difference, but also a decent difference. There's also a difference between their home and away rebounding for Minnesota. 54.6 at home, 50.1 away. Whereas you look at the Memphis Grizzlies, 57.5 rebounds at home, 59 rebounds away. And given what you've told me and us about Stephen Adams as a rebounder, I am led to believe that these numbers for Memphis are, you know, Stephen Adams has contributed and influenced these numbers a lot. And it seems, this is kind of like an entry point, it just seems like those rebounding numbers for Memphis tell us the story that Memphis and what they do is equally as decent home and away.
Yeah.
Whereas it seems like a team like Minnesota might be a bit more volatile home and away, and I think that is a celebration of who Stephen Adams is, because he's a chop wood collect water basketball player. It doesn't matter if he's doing that in his home court or in away court, Stephen Adams is going to chop wood and collect water for your basketball team. And further to the encouragement argument about Stephen Adams in this series, I think his rebounding is going to be quite interesting in the series, as well as his assists. Does anything kind of stand out for you there with his rebounding or assists? Because I've got those, like you mentioned, screen assists. Like, obviously, Stephen Adams, fantastic basketball player, can do a lot of shit on an NBA court. To me, it feels like his rebounding and his assists stand out the most. Do you have any ideas on how those things might be able to be applied for Stephen Adams? If we're like venturing into, like, forget the 50-50 argument about Stephen Adams might not play a whole lot in this series. We're well aware of that. We're open to that. That's all good. But if Stephen Adams is playing more than 20 minutes a game, how do you think his rebounding and assist ability can impact the game for Memphis?
Well, the assists will be interesting to see. Like, that'll just be curious to see how much they involve him. And I expect it will be a lot, because I think that's quite an easy set for them, is just to get, like, the handoff to Stephen Adams sort of in that, like, elbow position around the sort of free throw line, and just get cutters running around. Or, like, usually Desmond Bane is the best at it, is just, like, peeling around behind and then they'll bounce pass in. Or maybe it's just, like, if that gets covered, it's just a little handoff toss back to a three-point shooter or something like that. Also gets a lot of assists, just offensive rebounding and throwing it out as well is another one. It will be interesting to see how that works, like, how much they involve it. And I think it will be quite a bit. Like, I do think that's something they will try to, like, I always think of, like, when he was in OKC days when they were real good, it was you'd often see him score most of his points just in the first quarter, because it was a deliberate ploy of them just to, like, get the big man involved early, like, make sure he gets some early touches, not even for him, like, it's not one of those things where he needs the touches early on to set, it's to set a tone to the other team and say, like, we've got size, we got strength, we're coming at you, we're going to use it, sort of thing. And then you know, he might not get another shot. Like, there would be games where he would get, like, one more field goal attempt the entire rest of the game in the other three quarters, and it would probably be from an offensive rebound tipping or something like that rather than a pass. But they always tried to set the tone early. I think Memphis will do something similar, just because he is a bit of a unique talent that they have. And let's not forget Karl Anthony Towns, self-proclaimed greatest big man shooter of all time. Only self-proclaimed. I don't think anyone else believes he's ahead of the great man Dirk Nowitzki, for example. But, you know, he's clearly a a really talented, he's probably the best of that size right now in the NBA. He's a fantastic shooter. Not the best defensive player. Like, notoriously not the best defensive player. And if you're dragging him away from the basket, as you would be if he's guarding Steven Adams and Steven Adams is playing a bit high in those sort of sets that he gets the ball looking for his assists, not the worst shape, like, for the Grizzlies to find themselves in. So I do think they'll try to enforce a bit of that. Rebounds, shout out to the man Funaki Stats on Twitter here, who's done the research, but... obviously we know Steven Adams, like, offensive rebound, best dude in the league. But you did mention that his team in total, like, rebounds as a team, the Memphis Grizzlies, number one in the NBA. That is the 4th time in the last 8 years that he's been on the team that's led the league in total rebounds. He was third last year with the Pelicans. The 1 year where this didn't really count was that last year in OKC after Russell Westbrook left and they was, tipping the scale into rebuilding. But the year before that, they were second. The year before that, they were fifth. So he's been he has played a part on the top five total rebounding team in 7 of the last 8 years. At some point, that's just not even close to a coincidence. And you look at his stats, aren't necessarily the ones that reflect that. We know he gets heaps of offensive boards. His defensive ones aren't always on the same number. But along with screen assists, along with offensive rebounding, guess what? He also leads the NBA in box outs. Box outs don't necessarily mean that the rebound comes your way. It means you take the best rebounder of the other team out of the equation, and maybe one of your guards just swoops in and grabs it. We know that happened a lot with Russell Westbrook. Russell Westbrook used to cop the claim that he was just hogging stats and stealing rebounds from Steven Adams. I'm sure there were times where that was the case, but it was also a deliberate ploy. Like, they were trying to get Westbrook the rebound, and Adams was just making sure that the other team's big man couldn't challenge for it. That's another chop wood, carry water thing as well, isn't it? It's like sacrificing your own stats to make sure your team gets the stat. Not a coincidence, therefore, that he's been in a... Yeah, top five team rebounding, top five rebounding team for, what did I say, 7 of the last 8 years, top 3 for 6 of the last 8 years, and the number 1 for 4 of the last 8 years. And there's 3 different teams he's been involved in that time as well, so you can't just say it's the whole, the coaching system or whatever. This also plays into to one other point I want to make about the Memphis Grizzlies, which is the way they play as a team. Which is always worth getting that identity out there for people who maybe haven't tuned in as closely. The Grizzlies are not a stunning shooting team. Like, their field goal averages, their 3-point percentages, their 3-point attempts, even mid-table pretty much, across the board. They're just average. They're not bad, but they're also not particularly good. Where they're amazing is in those sort of transitional phases and those chop wood carry water type stuff, where they're fantastic at offensive rebounding and therefore second chance points, fantastic at getting steals and therefore points in transition, points off turnovers, fantastic at screening and great athletes around there as well, like Ja Morant leading the way. So excellent. And the offensive rebounding plays into this as well. Therefore points in the paint, those things add up. They're pretty much the best in the business at those things. And if you're good at those, points off turnovers, points in the paint, and what was the other one that I said? Second chance points. That's the team who maximizes their opportunities. And that's where they do so much damage, because you're you think you've got to stop, and then all of a sudden Steven Adams has got the offensive rebound and you're just straight back where you are and they get a second opportunity. And the Grizzlies are incredibly good at that. They're a very good defensive team, and they transition that defense into scoring points as well. That's how they do it. That's how they beat teams. And it comes down to a lot of fundamental type stuff, isn't it? It's focus, and it's everyone moving in the same direction, and aggression and not slacking off and all these things, keeping your standards up. That's one thing. They dropped a couple games after they clinched the second seed, and their coach was just on them in timeouts, where you could hear, and also in press conference afterwards, saying we let our standards drop. That's not good enough. That's not who we are as a team. Just making sure to stay on it, even in meaningless games like that. So you know that they're going to come out fired up for the playoffs with that exact same kind of thing. That is how they play. It suits Steven Adams to an absolute T. And Minnesota Timberwolves are going to have to try and keep up with that. They're going to have to try and, you know, limit Steven Adams on the offensive rebounds. They're going to have to limit their turnovers and all these kind of things. They're going to have to try keep Ja Morant out of the paint. Like, all of those things are easier said than done. But those are going to be like massive factors in determining whether the Grizzlies, because if the Grizzlies can get what they want in all those scenarios, they're going to cruise this through the series in like four or five games, you know. But if Minnesota can limit them, suddenly we got a pretty competitive series on our hands.
Everything you just described smells like a good team, like in this context,
for sure.
A good
Absolutely.
Basketball team, because there are clear signs of all the things that you need to do. Chopping wood, collecting water, this team does at a very high level. And of course, being from Aotearoa, we're obviously going to big up the man, Steven Adams, for his role in that. And I think that's actually really interesting, because there are some rugby league ideas that I think fit into the same category later on when we get to the Warriors. So yeah, pretty exciting. Pretty exciting to see Steven Adams in the playoffs again. This dude is probably Aotearoa's best basketball player ever, even though he hasn't represented Aotearoa yet. And he had a run with Oklahoma City Thunder. Like, it was kind of early in our niche case days where Steven Adams was playing in playoffs, and it was like a bit, looking back, it was a pretty amazing thing, but it didn't really feel amazing at the time. And now here we are, in a team that feels even more Kiwi than that Oklahoma City Thunder team. And it's just, it feels Latutu Taylor taking a wicket type of magic situation here with Steven Adams and the Memphis Grizzlies. So we are incredibly excited. Hopefully you're excited as well. And we'll obviously be tracking this a lot in our podcasts, on our Twitter, and just articles as well, and the email banger. So if you do love a bit of Steven Adams, if you do love a bit of just the Kiwi bloke fitting into one of the biggest sporting competitions, sporting leagues in the world, big up the man Steven Adams, as well as Sean Marks.
Yeah.
Interested to see how Sean Marks wiggles through this next little stage with the Brooklyn Nets. They won their playoff game, play-in game, which was good to see. And yeah. Shout out Sean Marks.
Yeah, they've got a very informed Boston Celtics team in the 2-7 seed matchup. So that's going to be tough, because like Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving were fantastic in that play-in game for the Nets. And still it was a lot closer than they would have been comfortable with. So there's definitely a question of whether they have like the depth behind their two superstars to do what they need to do. But if you got those two in the same team, and Kyrie Irving is allowed to play all the games now, which just helps, they're going to be competitive at least. But yeah, that Boston Celtics team have done a bit of a Memphis Grizzlies over the second half of the season, and just like really figured things out after a slow start. So that'll be a tough matchup for them.
I'd like to check in more with the Brooklyn Nets when there's actual like a full off season for Sean Marks to implement some things, because at the moment he's just kind of been reacting to, yes, he's the GM, but he's also had to react to what Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving want, what they're doing, you know, what their needs are, what their desires are, what their actions are. Sean Marks doesn't really have that much power over those dudes, so he's just been reacting, and I'm curious to see what he does with just the period of building and what he can do with that team over the next kind of year or two as things get a bit more interesting with the Brooklyn Nets. Nets. Aotearoa football here, Wildcat. I'm going to start. Throw a little doosra at you here. Sorry, I shouldn't say throw a doosra. That's insensitive. I'm going to bowl a doosra to you here, Wildcat.
Bowl a doosra within the standard allowable 15 degrees of elbow bend.
Going on. Can you describe in one word? I'm looking for one word for the football fans and one word for the under 20s, both of whom have played games against Australia recently. We'll get a bit into the nitty gritty. We'll chop some wood. We'll collect some water here. But for just curious, just to sum up your experience of just the big week of women's football for the land of Aotearoa. What's one word to describe the football Ferns after their series against Australia?
I mean, the phrase that comes to mind is work in progress, but that's not one word. So we'll say, let's go with...
That's right, that's right.
Okay, work in progress. We'll hyphen them all so it's the same as one word.
Just like a modern name. You just hyphen it all up and it's all good. Work in progress for the football Ferns. What do you reckon for the under-20s?
Exciting.
Cool. Yeah. Both terms have a bit of a positive tinge, which I like to see. What's a challenge to you here? Was there like a common thread between the football Ferns and the under-20s? Was there something that, because you would have watched all these games, you've talked about them, you've written about them, you've shared information about them. Was there something that you observed from the football Ferns and the under-20s, Wahine, that was shared between them in your mind, your observations, your insights?
Conceding goals against Australia from corners was one of them. I could come up with a couple of sort of smaller things. I think the most interesting point, though, is the one in which they don't align. And that's in the sort of like attacking player area, because if you look at the football Ferns as a work in progress, like defensively, they got a lot of good players. And they did extremely well in that first game in particular against Australia to repel them for as long as they did against just like back to the wall kind of thing. Claudia Bunge and Michaela Moore both had excellent games through both of the matches. But I think losing Rhea Percival, and I don't know, might come back to that idea, but losing Rhea Percival was a major factor in them just like not being able to enforce themselves on the game whatsoever. I do think that midfield combination is going to have to change in some way, and I suspect that Malia Steinmetz might be the big beneficiary of that, like the one true like number six option, like defensive midfielder that the team really has at the moment. But we know their biggest problem going back quite a while, like playing without Rhea Percival is a very new thing. She'd played 29 starts in a row, so they're extremely used to having her around. That's not something they were obviously prepared for. Not scoring goals is something that has been a worry for them for a considerable amount of time. I mean, the football Ferns scored in both those games. The under-20s scored in both those games. It was one goal in all four of them, like for the New Zealand team. So it's not like one was running away from things. It's a little bit more about just like styles and approaches and stuff like that. But if you look at the football Ferns, and one of the reasons they struggle with creativity is because they don't really have creative players. Like, I was watching a bit of USA versus Uzbekistan the other day, which first of all was like, why is Uzbekistan playing USA at women's football? Like, amazing opportunity, I'm sure, for the Uzbekistani players, but like the scores were 8-1 and 9-0. I don't know what America gains from that, but like you're seeing America playing without Rapinoe and Morgan and Tobin Heath wasn't there, and Kristen Press wasn't there, and Carly Lloyd's retired, so she was commentating on that game. And like you look at some of the players they didn't have, and yet they've just got this procession of just incredible, like really fast, really skillful, beating players one-on-one, just attacking weapons. And Australia are not as good as America. America is the best in the business, but Australia is a pretty good team who are going to make knockouts at World Cups and will probably be hoping to at least make the quarterfinals when they're co-hosting the next one, if not the semis. You know, they have a strong team with a lot of players playing for like Chelsea, Manchester City, like Lyon, Arsenal, like big clubs, a lot of the strong clubs in America as well. Like they always looked faster and stronger, and they could jump higher, and like just athletically there was only so much the Ferns could do against that. And the fact kind of is that we don't produce those types of players. We don't have players. I mean, Paige Satchell is probably a rare exception of a New Zealand attacker who's lightning quick, but that's lightning quick with an asterisk, because she's still like herself a work in progress in terms of getting the final product, the delivery into the area, the finishing and stuff like that. Has made huge strides over the last couple of years playing in the A-League, so definitely going in the right direction. But, you know, a project player who for Australia would be on the fringes of squads rather than, like, getting starts every game kind of thing. because we don't produce that many players, which is why that under 20s sort of little, you know, two game series there was really interesting, because you did have just a few more of the types of players that we don't really have, like, an equivalent in the senior team. Like Alyssa Winham, who is there in the Football Ferns team who plays in that type of way. Olivia Chance is the closest comparison, and it's not a straight comparison. They're like both very creative passes, but Winham is also someone who will take players on one-on-one, whereas, you know, Chance is a bit more of a... I think Liv Chance is borderline the best Football Ferns player at the moment now that Rhea Percival's injured, but like, I'm just pointing out stylistically rather than ability, like, they're, you know, they're a bit different. Like, Winham is a unique kind of player. You look at some of the forwards that were getting games for the Football Ferns, it's you know, girls like Gabby Rennie is what, 20 or something like that. Ava Collins is about 19, actually still eligible, the only player in that squad who's still eligible for this under 20 World Cup at the end of the year. Grace Jale is about 22 and just finished her first professional season. Jackie Hand got COVID, so couldn't play on this tour, but has been a part of recent tours. She's, you know, 22 or something herself, hasn't yet played professional football. Like, a lot of really young players in those areas, which shows that maybe we're developing a slightly, the types of players we haven't developed, and it's been a problem that we haven't developed those types of players in terms of being a more attacking team. Maybe that's starting to change. Like, if you just look at the fact that the players who are getting in those positions now are a lot younger, you look at an under-20s team that has players that are a little bit different to the types that have come before. Like, I thought Millie Clegg was super... For someone who I hadn't seen play at all, I don't think, before this series, I was incredibly impressed with what she did. Like, a genuine striker, like, goal-hunting striker, who can turn a player and has an eye for goal and is going to be like aggressive and trying to get there, who can hold the ball up, who looks like strong and athletic and stuff like that. Like, that's incredibly exciting, because you don't get those players otherwise without like an asterisk. It's like, you that yes, they can do this, but they also can't do this. It's like the trade-offs. Well, here's someone who looks like she might be an actual well-rounded like number nine. Don't really have one of those. And that's, like, I think that's pretty exciting to think of that. That's one of the reasons why I say this team is quite exciting. That, and also the fact that, thanks to their Wellington Phoenix experience that a lot of them have, they've actually got a bit of a head start on most under-20s teams in terms of, like, they've already got a style of play. They've already got combinations going. And at the Under-20 World Cup in Costa Rica in 4 months, in August, I think it is, that, you know, that's going to be something to get, like, quite interested in, to see how they translate that against other teams and other, you know, other teams at the same age grade. And I think they might genuinely do quite well. I'm excited to see how that goes. They weren't at full strength either for this thing. There's like three or four quite potentially really important players who weren't there as well. So like, cool. Like that's very promising. That's very exciting. But also that point about like some of the players that are coming through are a little bit like, you know, a different mold to the players that we've had before. Don't think this is gonna, I just don't think we've got time before the 2023 World Cup for that to like blossom and show and take full, you know, flowering, to keep the blossoming metaphor going, in that tournament. But come 2027, the time afterwards, and keep in mind that Yeka Kamplova is not just contracted until the next World Cup, she's contracted until that 2027 one afterwards, like a long-term contract there. Maybe that's when we'll start to see a little bit of a different, the scouting report's going to look a bit different on the Football Ferns when some of those players are starting to get through to that level. So that's the hope. But yeah, it's a little bit of a jarring thing over that Fern series, just seeing like the ways in which we struggle to compete just because we simply like, it's not a matter of our tactics should be better, we do this better, we do that better, more like, it's just we simply don't have the players to do what a team like Australia can do. That's frustrating, but it's also, you got to be realistic with it, right? You can't will something into existence that isn't there to begin with.
I imagine it was good for you, because those ideas would have been front and center and at the same period of time. Like, the Football Ferns are lacking these types of players, and then the next day you're watching the under-20s play, and they have these types of players. So you kind of, it's overlapping. It's not something they have in common, but it is something that there is like a string through both teams, which is interesting. Specifically, with the Football Ferns, and I imagine if the Football Ferns... Wait, so the Football Ferns, what is a prototype of a player that they do have a lot of?
Centre-backs is always pretty good. Yeah. Hard-working midfielders, although we probably need a few more hard-tackling, hard-working midfielders. Now that Rhea Percival isn't there to do the trick. But, you know, those kind of players who can... Let's keep the theme going. This might have to be the title of the episode, but players who can chop wood and carry water. What we need also is players who can do magical stuff on top of that, like just a few, just some special players on, like, to mesh with that. You've got the fundamentals, you've got the basics, a lot of players who can do the instructions, what needs to be done, but then also, like, who's going to... okay, so... You've got players who can chop wood, but who's going to light the fire, right?
Bit of a spark. You need a spark to light the fire.
Spark. That's a good one.
And I imagine, because, I mean, we're not, like, these are the types of players that Aotearoa is built upon. Like, these are the types of athletes that, like, we've just spent half an hour talking about Stephen Adams chopping wood, collecting water. So we don't have a shortage of those type of athletes. So I'd imagine the under-20s team has a bit of a combination, because you're saying that they have more naturally gifted athletes, more impactful athletes, athletes and footballers who are the spark. We also know that Aotearoa football, as you said, has a lot of like solid, hearty defensive players. So is the under-20s like a combination of those ideas, whereas the Football Ferns right now is kind of a bit more skewed to the chop and wood collecting water? And you're kind of looking at the under-20s team thinking, there's a bit of both, and that's what you need in any sports team.
Yeah, there definitely is. Like, because they drew their second, they lost 5-1 in the first game against Australia, but they drew the second one, 1-1. Millie Clegg scored a lovely goal, and they defended really, really well. Like, it was, it helped that they had an all A-League back four on this occasion. You had Marissa Vandermeer of Manchester City at left back, and then you had three Phoenix players, so Meekin at right back, and then Kate Taylor and Tadeu Moana Walker and centre-backs, like A-League calibers across the board. And you saw them playing like the Wellington Phoenix did. You know, it's Gemma Lewis is coaching both those teams, so again, it's not a coincidence, but you saw them like trying to play a higher line, trying to be aggressive, trying to like dive into challenges, win the ball, you know, don't let it bounce. Like being, just the aggression and defense was the same as we saw from the Phoenix throughout. So, and this time against like an under-20s team of similar, like the Aussie team was all domestic as well. They tend to develop players in Australia and then they go overseas afterwards. It's a little different to what you see in other, like no one's gone, like, they have good pathways for Australian players in Australia, and the A-League is a big part of that. So it was an A-League-based squad pretty much entirely from Australia. So players of the same level and the same age, it does make a difference, because that's the other thing about when you talk about someone like Millie Clegg looking like a great athlete playing against 18, 19-year-olds, developing that into being able to do that against like 28, 29-year-olds at an international level is a big difference. That's a huge leap to cover, like a lot of ground to make up there. So it's not one of those things where just because players look good at this level, it's a guarantee that they're going to all come through and be amazing by 2027 World Cup. That there's no guarantee there whatsoever, but they're at the stage where you want them to be at this level, so that's nice. And yeah, like there's definitely is that combination. I'll chuck out as well that I think the All Whites are probably a couple years ahead of this thing, because it's a similar thing where you think about like the squad that went to the 2010 World Cup was full of a lot of those types of like, you know, supreme battler type players, like the best version of that. But, you know, Ryan Nelson was a hard tackling, ball winning centre back. You know, he wasn't a silky midfielder or anything like that. But now we have Joe Bell and Marco Staminic, who kind of are silky midfielders, like in Sarpreet Singh as well, and Ryan Thomas, like guys like that. There's actually, and it's not just one or two other, like I just named four really, really good players who can play those positions. Like the All Whites were in the same position once upon a time. they're a few years ahead of the Football Ferns, and that some of these players have developed earlier and just had a head start, or just the generations have been a couple under 20 waves earlier, probably is the case, you know. But like, they've gone through the same journey, and they might be at a point now where we're seeing what that looks like when it actually comes to fruition. So hopefully the Football Ferns are just like 3 years behind where the All Whites are, and we'll get there sooner rather than later, you know.
What's the hard and fast bio on this Clegg player, lady, Wahine?
Check. Millie Clegg?
Where's she from?
She is an Aucklander. She played for Buckland's Beach as a junior. I didn't know bugger all about this. I've done some research myself trying to figure this out. Plays for Auckland United now, sort of, you know, Northern Women's Premier League. So the highest current domestic Winter League phase, and Auckland United will be a National League team at the end of the year as well, but didn't get to do that last year because National League, the Auckland teams weren't involved. It was South Central Series, and probably too young the year before that, so I haven't actually checked whether she popped up on like an Auckland bench or something at some point as like a 15 or 16 year old, maybe, I don't know. But from what I gather, played a lot of boys football at Buckland's Beach before going to Auckland United. So a lot of her development actually came playing like under 15s, under 17s, alongside the lads, you know, and scoring goals, because there are some videos around on the internet as well. Like, she's scoring heaps of goals at that level. There's no dramas whatsoever. She's what I like about it is that she does look like someone who's who has a hunger for goals as well. Like, you want players who are going to be team first and all that, who will, you know, chop the wood and carry the water, but you also do need someone, like, and probably a couple of players, like, it just really helps to have someone who will do that, but also will be like, I'm going to cut a corner here and just make sure I score a goal. I'm going to follow up on this shot and put it away, because, like, this is what I do. Like, I score goals. A poacher, a finisher, you know what I mean? And she seems like someone who has that very much in her locker, that instinct. And that's, again, beautiful to see, you know?
Chopping wood and carrying water. When I think about rugby league and I think about what the Warriors are doing well, I'm thinking chopping wood and carrying water. I'm thinking about a forward pack led by Adam Fanua Blake that can go forward. And I'm thinking Sean Johnson kicking the footy into space. Because, like, I think Warriors fans have become very well acquainted with penalty kicks that go 10 metres. Like, I don't know if it was like growing up watching Stacey Jones or some shit like that, but like, anytime there was a penalty kick, especially if it was in the middle of the field, you were chewing off 15 metres, 10 metres. Whereas some of the kicks Sean Johnson was doing on the weekend, a penalty in the Warriors' half, if he's kicking 30 metres, well, then you're in good ball down the other end of the field. And it's a very different equation. And I think those... And then you combine, like, Reece Walsh and Chanel Harris-DeVita both have left boots. And the way I'd describe it is to think of them as one kicker. So it's not about... we're just looking for two kicking options here. Sean Johnson and a left footer. So Reece Walsh and Harris Tevita, their kicking games combine for one total kicking game, because Harris Tevita's got a limited kicking game. Reece Walsh is a fullback who might have two kicks a game. Whereas Sean Johnson's doing 10 kicks, Harris Tevita and Walsh might combine for 6 kicks. But they're both left-footed. So if you've got a forward pack that's going forward, and you've got Sean Johnson executing a solid kicking game, and you've got a left-footed kicking game, and all the other blokes are just running hard and supporting the inside men, defending for each other, that's a rugby league team that is chopping wood and collecting water, which sets up their game against the Roosters, and obviously the Roosters are favourites here. But I do see a situation that could happen where the Roosters are off for whatever reason. It's happened before against the Warriors. There have been games when the Roosters have been below par, Warriors have been good, they win. This time around, though, it doesn't feel like the Warriors need to be good. They can just do their chop and wood collecting water. And if the Roosters are off, they're going to be in the mix. And it's all just kind of, a lot of it stems from Fenua Blake being one of the best props in the NRL and Sean Johnson being one of the better kickers in the NRL as well. And I think that's just I don't think it's reason for optimism. It's just maybe I'm just finding greater clarity in what this team is. And if you've got a team that more often than not is going to have a better forward pack and you've got good kickers, you're in the mix. And I think that's a simplified way of viewing Warriors footy. And I think a lot of people tend to complicate it. Whether it's looking for the razzle dazzle, whether it's looking for more of a grinding style of footy, or just like this player's doing this, this player's shit, this player's that, whatever it is. Like, I don't know. But this Warriors team, Fenua Blake's leading the forward pack, Sean Johnson's leading the rest of the team, and they both have skills that give the Warriors a chance, you know, like, and then it's just up to the Warriors what, because I actually think under Nathan Brown right now, the team is executing a very simple style of footy led by those ideas, but also if everyone just runs hard, it's going to be okay. If everyone rips in defensively, it's going to be okay. And like Reece Walsh is defending the try line as best as he can, which is a good example. Like, he's trying hard. Wade Egan's a little bloke who plays 60, 70 minutes in the middle of the park. So it just seems like a very basic Warriors team. And I'm curious how that basicity, that's not a word, but I made it up, against the Roosters go. Because as we know, the Roosters could just be too good. But also the Roosters, if they don't show up, the simple, basic nature of the Warriors could step in to do some things.
Yeah, a lot of what you're describing there sounds to me like a definition or an explanation of like what people mean when they say the arm wrestle, or I don't know, it's arm wrestle. Tug of war seems like more of a better metaphor, like the push and pull sort of thing going on between one team has a set, the other team has a set, the other team has a set, back and forth, over and over. And if you like, if you are getting go forward from your forward pack, which is where that stems from, otherwise you're talking about line breaks and like shifting the ball and stuff, which is not basic, not really basic game plan. That's more of the razzle dazzle stuff.
That's
yeah.
Melbourne Storm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Get it to the edges, go round.
Yeah, but if you're like rolling through the middle, getting, you know, 10 meters a carry and making sure you get like that sort of, you know, that 50 meter gain, with, you know, 45 to 55, whatever meter gain every set. And then you get a good kick away. And then the other team starts from within their 20 first tackle, you know, they're unlikely unless you make a mistake, miss a tackle, or they, you know, do something special. Unless you play the Melbourne Storm, like, you're then in a good defensive shape in order to keep them from being able to get an attacking kick, which might lead to a try, to get them to, you know, kicking along at the other end. And then you do the same thing. Like, that's the tug of war, isn't it? It's like going back and forth. And it is a basic game plan, and one I'm very accustomed to because I'm a Dragons supporter. So I've had a decade of watching teams try to play exactly that kind of way. I'm currently watching a team who is trying to play that way with no capability of being able to do it because they can't get any meters up the middle. Decent kicking game though. Do like old Ben Hunt off the boot. Wish he had some help would be beneficial. But so it goes. But yeah, that's how you get yourself into the game, isn't it? Into the contest is being able to do those sort of fundamentally type stuff, and then it becomes a matter of like who blinks first, who's going to make the mistake, who's going to do something special, who's going to break this game open in some way. That feels like where the Warriors might probably going to fall short. But having said that, like, Reece Walsh can certainly spot a gap in the line, and he can duck his head through and off you go. Sean Johnson can do that in a couple different ways. He can do it as a runner, and then increasingly over the last like sort of three or four seasons, we've seen he can do that with a pass or a kick as well. And Chanel Harris-Tavita is a pretty highly skilled player in his own way as well. So like, when the Warriors complete at a high percentage and don't make the kind of mistakes that cost them, same as any team, I suppose. When you make mistakes, it's the first thing you can do to just, like, spoil everything else, because it's hard to get those good, like, sets and then a good defensive kick and then starting aggressively defending if you're giving the ball away in your own half, dropping the ball and tackle two and stuff like that, and giving away penalties defensively as well, and just, like, piggybacking the other team down. Like, if you do those things, you're probably going to lose anyway if you're doing that more than the other team. That's the easiest way to sabotage yourself. But yeah, like, I mean, the Warriors do have a team that is capable. Like, we've seen this over the last 3 weeks. Like, they're pretty good at doing those, doing all those things that you described earlier, and they do have a bit of flash and pizzazz in there as well. So that, like, if they can keep it close, they're going to be in games. I think the big test is, can they continue to chop wood and carry water against a much, much better team in the Roosters than any of the teams they've beaten in the last 3 weeks, or any of the teams they've played at all to this point of the season? Because the fixture list has been kind, and it's going to balance out sooner rather than later. So I think this is a pretty big test in terms of seeing where the Warriors are actually at, to be honest, because I don't know that we've really learned a whole lot in the last 2 weeks. We've seen, like, similar performances where they've been able to grind out wins against weaker teams or weaker performing teams on the day, sort of thing. Roosters are not that. Like, Roosters is a big shift. Like, it's a massive leap from what they've been doing to get wins to translating that into against a good team. But, I mean, if you, like I say, you don't make mistakes, you're in the contest playing that style of footy.
Two things stand out about, like, how NRL footy is played right now, and one of them is the kicking. So if you take Sean Johnson out and you have Cody Nikorima at halfback with this current team, you're not getting the same kicking, because Cody Nikorima can't find open pasture within the opposition 20-meter zone on their try line. So then you're putting more pressure on Reece Walsh and Chanel Harris-DeVita and their kicking games. Whereas Sean Johnson, you mentioned the Dragons. The Dragons are in the contest because they got a rugged forward pack, and Ben Hunt can kick a footy. Right, it's just a good starting point. And then you think about the best halves in the NRL. Nathan Cleary's the best half because he's got the best kicking game, among other things. Like, you have to do other shit. You've got to run the footy, tackle hard, and all that. But Nathan Cleary's got the best kicking game. Mitchell Moses can absolutely destroy a kick. Like, he can kick at the whole field, let alone his attacking weaponry. Let me look around. Who else are some of the other halves? Jerome Hughes, fairly decent kicking game. Nico Hines. Like, Jerome Hughes and Nico Hines were fullbacks at the Storm system, and they are currently, obviously, Hughes halfback at the Storm, Hines halfback at the Cronulla Sharks. Both of them have long kicking games, and that is so crucial, to the point where if you take Sean Johnson out, it changes how the Warriors have to play their footy, because whoever else is going to play halfback can't kick the ball like Sean Johnson can. And another thing is how direct the runners have to be. And I said this maybe last week with Chanel Harris-DeVita. And when you're watching the Warriors, there's a lot of very direct running. Marcelo Montoya is out this week, and Dallin Watene-Zelezniak comes in. What do we know about Watene-Zelezniak? Runs like a psycho. And that's going to be good. Jesse Arthurs is finding a bit of form, and he looks like he's, like, got a NOS canister in his, you know, shorts compared to what he was doing at the Broncos. Like, he's just running faster. We saw a bit of Sean Johnson running game step in and all that stuff, but when I look through this team, because obviously we've talked about Fenua Blake, but Matt Lodge is pretty good running the footy as well, and all the other blokes in the forward pack and the team, everyone is capable of very direct running. And when you're doing that, it opens up everything else around you. So again, that's another chopping wood, carrying water thing, because everyone runs the footy hard and direct. So when there is a subtle shift, it opens up space. Like, every time Chanel Harris-DeVita runs the footy hard, he is setting up the next play when he skips to the outside, throws a cut-out ball, and the Warriors score. Because everything is drawing the players in. Whereas I think the bad NRL teams, especially the bad halves, they don't run the footy. Or blokes are running sideways, they're going that way, there's a lot of passing. Like, I think teams might want to throw the footy around and get into a bit of that Melbourne Storm shifting the footy type of footy. But if you're just passing to the sideline, you're not actually doing anything. Even if you are executing like a decoy play, second man play, well-designed play, you're just moving the footy out to the sideline. Whereas the good teams, whether it's a half, whether it's a centre, whether it's getting the edge forward involved, like, what does Ewan Aitken do? He just gets the footy, he runs very hard.
He certainly doesn't pass.
Yeah, he's not...
He never has.
He's not a Wade Graham, right? Like, no. He's Ewan Aitken, and he just gets the footy, he runs. I've had some really deep thoughts about Katoa and Surinen, which I don't really want to get into, so that opens my mind, like, Bailey Surinen might be better as an edge forward in this team because he's doing all the other shit. Katoa runs the footy very hard, but Bailey Surinen might be better at working defensively with the half alongside him. He might be better at running a decoy, running through the line. Because I've thought, like, why isn't Katoa just starting edge forward every single week? Well, there are other things that are part of that job that you have to do. But then if you get Katoa coming off the bench, what does Katoa do? What does Aaron Penny do? What does Bunty Arfoa do? They all run very hard and direct. What is Cody Nikorima's best skill set? He's a whippet. He's fucking fast. He's skillful. So that adds something. And I think I'm kind of talking myself around to the Warriors might be aligned with what NRL footy is about this year. Because you need, like, because everyone's talking about this, the speed of the game and all that shit. Well, I don't know, it's still rugby league. You still need to run hard. You still need to, like, manipulate numbers through your physicality and through your skill set. And I think this Warriors team has a bit of that, which is presents a fascinating matchup against the Roosters. And as we know, Roosters won the NRL women's competition on the weekend. Three Kiwis, Leanne Tafonga on the wing, Racine McGregor, Kiwi Ferns half. She was in the halves, and we had Maya Hill-Moana starting at prop. So I went into those three at the top of the variety show. So the top of that segment in the variety show is me doubling down on the Roosters being the best Kiwi NRL club in the NRL, and that is still the case. Here 2 days later, like, nothing's changed, funnily enough. Joey Manu, fantastic form. Jared Whitehair Hargraves is still going around, still one of the best middle forwards in the NRL. Sotili Tupanua starts on an edge this week for the Roosters once again. And Siosiwa Tokiaho, Otara Scorpions Jr., he's off the bench. Nice little resurgent patch for Tokiaho, because there was a bit of noise last season about him possibly leaving the Roosters, possibly going to the Super League, but he's still here and he's adding to the Roosters still, which is encouraging. No Nofahu White this season yet, but he is named on the extended bench. And also on the extended bench is Renofa Tony. He left the Bulldogs. He's from Wellington. I think he's a Porirua Junior from Wellington. Actually, I've had a chuckle at the Bulldogs' expense a few times, Wildcard, because you think about Morgan Harper. He was at the Bulldogs. Remus Smith. He was at the Bulldogs. And then I went in. The Bulldogs won the New South Wales Cup. Might have been 2019, I think. All the Bulldogs NRL players, like players in the Bulldogs team who have gone on to play NRL, are playing NRL at other clubs. All the Newton Jets, Newtown Jets, which align with the Cronulla Sharks, most of the players in that Jets team who played in that grand final who lost to the Bulldogs, they're playing for the Cronulla Sharks. So I don't know what the fuck the Bulldogs are doing. Like, they have consistently let all their players go. Like, they let Remus Smith go. They let Morgan Harper go. Then they sign all these other expensive outside backs. Nick Cottridge. They get Corey Allen. Like, those dudes aren't even contributing. Nick Cottridge is back at the Raiders. Corey Allen's in reserve grade. And you had all these players in your team. You had a team that won the reserve grade competition who have now left the Bulldogs. Like, it makes no sense, and that's just a shit club. But the Roosters, wild card. The Roosters are not a shit club. They are one of the best clubs. But something interesting is happening here with the Roosters, and this is my focus right now. A crop of Roosters recruited from Aotearoa have left the Roosters. This started when Sonny Bill returned to the Roosters and Asu Kepa'oa had to make way. He went to the Tigers. He joined Kiwis coach Michael Maguire at the Tigers, and I think he had a major knee injury at the start of this year. Christian Tuipulotu. Now, if you think back, Tuipulotu was in the Warriors system, and then the Roosters rolled out the red carpet for him, took him down to Queenstown, showed him like a couple of the Roosters NRL players, and you know, a bit of mingling with the Roosters. Tuipulotu is now with the Manly Seagulls. Another player who's left, who I've talked about, is Moala Graham Taufa. He is with the Eels now, and he's playing under 21s, I think, with the Eels. So the Roosters do a great job. Like Joey Manu, everyone knows the story around Joey Manu. Fly in, fly out. He'd go to Sydney, and then he'd go back to Tokoroa to go to school for Monday and Tuesday. That's not necessarily specific to Joey Manu. That's just how the Roosters operate. There's no salary cap sombrero. They just invest their money in resourcing their Aotearoa recruitment, which is still happening. But that type of situation happened for Adam Pompey. And it's happened for a lot of other Roosters juniors from Aotearoa. Tuipulotu, Asu Kepa'oa, Graham Taufa, Nofahu White. Like, all those lads have had a similar type of investment in them from the Roosters. But right now, there's quite a concentrated group of their Kiwi NRL juniors who have gone on to play NRL, like Nofahu White, Tupanoia, Joey Manu. They are all quintessential Roosters Aotearoa recruitment. Now we've got a few more lads leaving the Roosters. So what I'm seeing is there are less Kiwi NRL juniors in the Roosters reserve grade, in the Roosters under 21s jersey flag as well. But there is a very good crop of Kiwi NRL juniors with the Roosters at a lower level. So there's kind of like the next wave. There's the next wave of the Joey Manu, Tupanuia, Nofahu White bracket. Guys like Benaya Ioelu, Salisi Bokete, I believe. They lead. I think there's another dude, Javan Stevenson-Hulla from the Manawatu. Like, some of those lads are getting game time. Cassius Tia is a halfback in the Roosters system as well. So all of which is, I believe, is important because I've got the Roosters as the best Kiwi NRL club in the NRL and thus the world. But there is, when we're working with the best Kiwi NRL club, we have to observe and we have to learn what's happening with their system. And there are some of these lads leaving the Roosters system to get game time elsewhere, which is what's happening with Ronald Volkman, who the Warriors who have apparently signed. The Roosters tend to get a lot of really high quality juniors, and if that's the case, there's less opportunities for them at the NRL level. So you are seeing a lot of Roosters, Kiwi NRL juniors leave the club, but the Roosters being the Roosters have another wave coming in to fill all those spots as well.
It's funny how much more efficient that ends up being when you actually put that resources in, like, deeper in the development, like, pathways. And you see, like, because, like, you know, the trickle-down economic model doesn't work. But the trickle-up economic model kind of does. And this is, like, a rugby league equivalent of that, isn't it? Whereas it's the same in all these sports. Like, if you actually, like, develop them so you've got better players at like age 15, 16, 17, you end up with better players at age 20, 21, 22. Like it moves upwards like that. Whereas if you go at them like targeting other, like you want to be the Bulldogs and target everybody else's, backup options at all in the same. Like, I mean, R.I.P. to Matt Dufty's NRL career. I don't know if he's coming back from that, unfortunately, because he's a player I've always liked. But you know, so it goes. Bad business decision. You don't go from the Dragons to the Bulldogs. You just sort of taint yourself at some point.
Well, he had no choice.
Well, he had no choice about staying at the Dragons. He maybe didn't need to go to the Bulldogs. Like, then again, maybe that was the only offer on the table. I don't know. Who knows? It's a pity because he is such a skillful attacking player, but just couldn't defend in any way. He's just too small. But yeah, that doesn't work nearly as well, like trying to sign talented 20, 21, 22-year-olds where you could just, like, you get in earlier and then you develop them to that point and it works out cheaper in the long run. Same in all of these sports. Like, just quickly as well, what's the lowdown on this Volkman dude that the Warriors have scooped up?
He's starting number 6 for the Roosters under-21s this week. My everything below NRL for me is strictly Kiwi NRL, so I don't really care for any Australian dudes, so I don't know much about him, but Roosters have no shortage of talent. So, like, you can't view him leaving the Roosters as anything negative. Like, the Roosters hate him, so they're going to let him go, you know? The Roosters just have so much talent that they have to pick, the same way the Warriors do at a junior level, but they have a less proven track record of making the right decisions. Roosters, on the other hand, tend to make the right decisions. But I think this goes back to the idea I shared last year, where the Warriors don't have top tier juniors in the halves positions, which is fine as long as you're aware of that and you plug those holes. The Warriors have fantastic junior depth in every other position, except maybe, no, they got Otakulo at hooker, which is good as well. But they don't have talented halves juniors from Aotearoa in their system. And what you're seeing, because they also signed Luke Metcalf from the Sharks, who's playing reserve grade. So they're bolstering their halves depth with young Australian dudes, which is interesting. And if you're thinking about the Warriors moving forward, like, instead of worrying about where all these dudes fit in, just think about the Warriors. They're going to have Reese Walsh, Luke Metcalf, Chanel Harris-DeVita, Sean Johnson, Ronald Volkman, and no Ash Taylor. Like, fantastic. You just want those dudes in your club. And I think that's a good way of, a good modus operandi, maybe, is just, because I have identified that as a hole in their junior system. And there are halves from Aotearoa, like Cassius Tia is from Auckland, and he is with the Roosters. There's another dude from Tokoroa, I think, Cassius Cowley. He's with Wynnum. Like, there are, Sione Moala was with the Warriors SG Ball team, and he is now playing Canberra Raiders under-21s. I haven't seen where Sebastian Jack is playing this season, but he was like the halves partner for the SG Ball team, and he was playing Redcliffe last season. So I don't know where he's at, but so there is like junior halves from Aotearoa, but the Warriors have identified whatever, you know, they've done their process to identify their needs. And I think it's pretty obvious when they've signed Luke Metcalf and now they're signing Ronald Volkman. I think they also signed Dylan Walker from the Seagulls as an older veteran. And then you look at them signing Ash Taylor as an older veteran as well. What do all those signings have in common? They are Australian players who are either straight up halves or have experience in the halves. So I'm purely observing that, and it's a trend. So, like, I don't know what it means, but I think it's pretty clear what is happening there. Speaking of Redcliffe, though, there's only under 18s in Queensland this weekend, obviously long weekend, and Redcliffe under 18s have a bye. So there's no reserve grade Redcliffe and there's no under 21s Redcliffe. So there's no Redcliffe this weekend. But last weekend we did have Ali Liatawa scoring 4 tries in his first game for Redcliffe Dolphins, and that was the under-21s competition. He started at centre. Now, he was a member of the Warriors SG Ball team. I think he was playing fullback for most of that season. King's College first 15 player, Papatoa Panthers Jr. Yeah, he scored 4 tries. Also in that under-21s team, because this was their second game of the season, but there were no Warriors, I don't think, in round one. I think you might have only had Zion Mai'u'u in the forward pack, whereas this round, last weekend, you had Liatawa starting at centre, Eric Afusuanga, another King's College first 15 player. He was on the wing for the under-21s. He played on the wing for the under-18s much of last season. You had Kinakepu starting at prop, Leighton Finau starting at prop, and those were the Warriors juniors. So good little sprinkling there for the under-21s. What happened when, what did we do? We had Dean Mariner scored 4 tries on Queensland Cup debut. He's from Auckland, Marist Saints Jr. Ali Liatawa, Hastings Daring Colts debut, under-21s footy in Queensland, 4 tries on debut. So, all good, you know? All good for the Kiwi NRL stocks there. And also, I continue to be fascinated about the transition from Aotearoa to Australia, because this tells us the strength of Aotearoa Rugby League, is how players transition. Obviously, everyone's different. Everyone's got a different journey, different challenges, different situations. But I am curious about how players move between the two countries and the various levels. So someone like Ali Liatawa, he was playing New Zealand Rugby League under-20s this time last year, maybe. Then he played first 15 for King's College. So he has just finished high school. Now he goes to Queensland under-21s footy and he scores 4 tries. That transition is where you learn something, right? And there are players, I'm not too equipped with the specifics, but there are players playing in the current New Zealand NZRL under-20s competition who are either with NRL clubs now or have been. And there's a bit of a crossover there, which tells me that the level of footy isn't as big a gap between the level of footy as has previous been the case. Of course, there's a gap, but the gap isn't that big because NRL clubs are happy for juniors to stay in Aotearoa. Then again, a lot of the Southeast Queensland stuff that I've noted is dudes moving to Southeast Queensland with their families to get better competition. But then there are other cases of players instantly leaving Aotearoa and impacting under-18s, under-21s, or reserve grades. So it's quite interesting. That transition is where you learn the most and where I'm learning the most about the quality of Aotearoa Rugby League. Also with regards to NRL Women. Which reminds me, if you are a rugby league freak, there is the under-20s final and the women's final at Mount Smart Stadium this weekend, the national competitions. I think you've got South Island versus Akarana maybe in the under-20s, and then you've got women's is Akarana versus County. So that's where you learn.
There you go. Is that like the transition of players moving to Oz, is that something where you see, like, because you mentioned how the Roosters tend to take it a bit, like, deeper and helping guys, like, fly back and forth and still, like, stay enrolled in school and stuff like that. And is that something where you see, like, quite drastic in, like, across the entire NRL scope with all the clubs? Is that something you see, like, quite a difference between different teams' approaches? Or is there sort of, like, the Roosters are a little better at it than other teams, perhaps, but most teams sort of have the same kind of formula or strategy or whatever. Like, is there much, like, is that like a vast difference between different teams and how they do that, like how they integrate and help Kiwi players, you know, get involved?
The flying in and out is, but I don't think that's happening much pandemic onwards.
Like, no, yeah.
That was definitely a pre-pandemic strategy where I think a lot of the Roosters Kiwi NRL juniors right now in Sydney for their competitions. But what you might have is a case where someone like Benaiya Iowelu, even during the pandemic, he would play SG Ball or a Cyril Connell Cup, whatever it was, and then come back to Aotearoa after those 10 weeks early in the year. The fly-in, fly-out thing is unique. Interested to see if it continues with greater flexibility there. What you're seeing far more common now is like NRL clubs have academies and development camps in Aotearoa. So they will send people, or they've got like New Zealand. Yeah, here's fucking Jerry Smith. He's the Roosters New Zealand development officer. And then they have camps. I think like Daniel Anderson's heavily involved in this. I've seen him involved with the Roosters. So then you've got a club like, so the Broncos, Dean Mariner was in Auckland and he was part of the Broncos Academy as well as other Broncos juniors from Aotearoa. Jordan Rickey was a great case study for that. He stayed in Christchurch while a member of the Broncos Academy, finishes school, goes to Brisbane. The Cowboys have a lot of like regional Aotearoa. So they'll have like a like Griffin Niami and I think the one of the Fa'atili brothers was part of the Cowboys Academy development system in New Zealand. And then when they can, they move to Australia. So the Roosters, again, it's not about the salary cap sombrero. The Roosters flex their financial muscle in investing in greater resources for their juniors, because other NRL clubs can't afford, like you can't fucking fly in Jerry Smith from Auckland to Townsville for a weekend, you know, that's not happening, because the Cowboys can't afford it, and it's a fucking nightmare of a flight, I imagine. Roosters can do that, whereas a lot of the other clubs, they just kind of, I'll leave us with this, we'll finish the podcast here. The fresh wrinkle is the under-20s competition in New Zealand, because players were signed from the under-20s competition in New Zealand last year. So now there is a New Zealand Rugby League under-20s competition. Like some of those dudes, like Leotawa, was playing under-20s while he was still at high school. The same with Zion Mai'u'u. They were playing in the Auckland teams while they were still playing First 15 rugby. But then you might have other dudes who have finished school who are 18, 19 years old and they're playing Premier Men's Rugby League in Aotearoa and under-20s this time of year. Under-20s is where the scouts are going to be watching, the recruitment officers are going to be watching. And that's the new wrinkle where as long as that under-20s competition keeps getting better and the profile keeps increasing and it becomes a solid fixture of the Aotearoa calendar, NRL clubs are going to tap in more. So then you've got a greater mix, because a lot of what we've been talking about is dudes being linked to NRL clubs when they are 14, 15, 16 years old. Well, now you're going to see players signed from the under-20s competition when they are 18, 19 years old. And I think that is a good wrinkle of NRL recruitment from Aotearoa, because we just want a wider mix. We want a wider mix of regions recruited. We want a wider mix of positions recruited. And we want a wider mix of age players recruited. We want players on the scholarship who get sent to straight to Australia, who like a Sydney club might put them into a school where they play rugby union and rugby league, and then they're in the system, they're right there. But we also want the 18, 19-year-old dude who's got a chance. He impresses, he dominates the under-20s competition, and bang, smart recruitment officer signs him, develops him a bit, gets him to Australia. So we just want a wider mix, and that's part of the Kiwi NRL takeover. In the same way, many of these young female footballers come from around Aotearoa. They come in. They're coming into the football fans from different situations around the world, from different regions in Aotearoa. We've got different age groups in the football fans. Like all these sports that we are noting greater depth and explosions of talent, the key indicator of fantastic times to be alive in this regard is the mix. And it's the mix and the variations and the wide variety of players and where they come from, how they got there, etc., etc.
Yeah, the more pathways there are for players to get to the top, the more players can get to the top. Because you're increasing access to players. Like your 18-year-old NRL prospect isn't just like thrown on the scrap heap because they've missed their chance. Like there's more opportunities coming along. Might be a late bloomer, whatever. That happens all the time, I'd imagine, especially in a sport like rugby league. And then also just the more pathways there are, the easier, more likely you are for any individual prospect to find the pathway that best suits them, rather than everyone having to go through the same one, crowding each other out. Like different players develop differently. That's part of it. Part of good player development is understanding that. So yeah, the more pathways that there are, the better situation, full stop. Like it's just going to lead to more talented players at the top end.
And big it up to one of the biggest NRL pipelines, First 15 Rugby.
Yes, exactly.
That's it. That's the niche cast. Māori ora. Stay beautiful. Enjoy the weekend of Jah and all other religious figures. Jah bless. Kia kaha and cheers.